Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio. And we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Fairway Market. Welcome to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm your host, Chef Smarty Pants, Erica White. And we're getting there. We're getting there. It's almost the end of February. Just hold on. Today I was walking to the station. It was 5:45. It was still light out. So that is good news. I saw my first little spring flower bulb coming up the other day. I was just telling Jack. First little snowdrops coming up. So there's hope. There's hope. Just hold on. It's coming. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there. So welcome to Why We Cook. So human beings, us, we are omnivores. That's how we were designed. That's how we were created. We are designed to basically eat everything. That's why we have these little sharp teeth on the sides and crushing molars in the back. I know some people would like to argue this fact, but I don't want to argue it with you because it's true. We're designed to be omnivores, and that's what I am. If you are a vegetarian or vegan, that's okay with me. Just leave me out of it. I don't have a problem with that, with your choice. But occasionally, I want to eat some animals. It's just how I am. I like the protein. I like how they taste. I work for Heritage Radio Network. We are an arm of Heritage Foods USA. We're all about that. But the funny thing is, even though I sort of love the idea of it and I embrace it, I don't actually eat that much meat. I'll have a little bite, small amounts here and there. I rarely sit down to like a big meal of like a big chunk of steak. You know, I was going out to dinner the other night in Williamsburg and we walked by Peter Luger. And I thought, I have less than zero interest in going there and eating some big slab of meat. I'd rather eat like a little piece of some really good, interesting meat, you know, mixed in with something else. And a lot of it kind of depends on what I'm doing during the day. If I'm teaching, if I'm working an event, you know, because what I eat for dinner sort of ultimately depends on where I am and what I'm doing. And I'm not really like, I'm a protein person at breakfast, but not like sausage. I want like an egg or cheese. And lunch for me is usually something like a big pile of kale and broccoli rabe and like some sardines or salmon. So sometimes at dinner, I wind up eating some poultry or some meat or something like that, or usually some fish. It all depends. So it's usually circumstantial. And for some reason, circumstances aligned this past weekend that put me in a situation where I was eating chicken at every meal. I realized it, like from Friday night through Monday night, there was chicken being eaten every night. It was like I was back in my childhood. We ate a lot of chicken in my youth, I think because it was cheaper than meat. So what happened was I went to Costco a few weeks ago. And I think I've mentioned this before, that Costco now sells these Coleman Ranch organic chickens, which, you know, I do work for an arm of Heritage Foods, so I shouldn't even be buying those. But I'm poor. Well, I'm not poor, but I'm not rich. Anyway, so once in a while I buy these chickens at Costco, these Coleman organic chickens, and I think they're pretty good quality. Of course, they advertise that they're vegetarian fed, and chickens aren't vegetarians. Chickens are omnivores like us. They like to eat bugs and worms and things like that. So the vegetarian feed kind of bothers me because they're not really being fed the right thing, but yeah, whatever. We all have to make compromises. I'm not going to buy like Purdue, that's for sure. And they actually taste really good, these Coleman chickens. They're very flavorful. So I bought them. Although now we're selling, Heritage Foods, I think, is selling chickens now. And I'll have to try those. I'm going to taste those. I think it's a pretty new addition to the Heritage repertoire. But anyway, so I bought a couple of chickens. I sell them like in these two packs. And I bring them home and I always put them in the freezer, unless I'm going to cook one right away. And what happens is I buy the stuff, I put it in the freezer, and then I forget that it's in the freezer. And then I wind up with like a freezer 5 years later with all kinds of stuff in it that I never eat. Like a couple of months ago, I cleaned out my freezer and I found a guinea hen in there that dates back to when we had guinea hen in the curriculum where I teach. We haven't had guinea hen in the curriculum in probably 7 years. So that guinea hen had to go in the garbage. I might have eaten it, but yeah, it's a little old even for me. So anyway, why did I wind up eating all this chicken? Get to the point, please. So I bought these chickens, and so I decided Friday night, oh, I'll take one out. We'll roast it. We'll have dinner. So I took it out, thawed it out. And what I like to do, which I had done a few weeks ago and was really good, was instead of roasting it whole, I like to do a pollo al mattone, Italian-style way of cooking chicken, which means chicken under a brick. Now, I don't have any bricks, although I do have some cobblestones that I took once from a street that was being torn up, but I don't use the cobblestones. So pollo al mattone is chicken under a brick. So you take your whole chicken and you take out the backbone. You have to know how to do that. It's not that hard. You basically stand the chicken up on its butt and you take a knife and you cut down one side of the backbone. The knife goes through the ribs, right down one side. And then you flip it over, so she's standing on her head, and you take the knife and you go down the other side of the backbone. You take out the backbone. You open the chicken up like a big book. You make a little notch in the cartilage in the middle of the breastbone, and you sort of pop that back. And what happens is the keel, which is the actual breastbone, sort of pops, and you can just pull that out. I know it's not something you can really describe on radio. I'm sure if you look online, you can find a video. Anyway, so you take out the backbone. You take out the keel bone. You have a flat chicken. If you leave it like that, it's called spatchcocked, which is a great word. I like to use that when I'm teaching, and everybody kind of twitters spatchcock. They don't actually tweet, not that kind of twittering. I guess they titter, not Twitter. So you take this now flat chicken, and I like to cut it in half. And then you take a cast iron pan, and you get the cast iron pan nice and hot. You put a little bit of oil in it. Dry off your chicken, you season it, and you put it skin side down in the cast iron pan, and then you're supposed to put the brick on top of it because that flattens it out, and you get a lot more skin to pan surface contact, so you get much crispier, you get more crispier skin, basically, and it flattens all out, so it cooks really evenly. Now, you don't have to use a brick, so what I did is I took my 12-inch cast iron pan, put the chicken in that, and then I took my 10-inch cast iron pan, and I just plopped that on top, and that was the weight, and it was great because it was small enough that it allowed for steam to get out, but big enough that it covered enough of the chicken to keep it flat. So that is what pollo al mattone is. So you press it like that for probably about 10 minutes over kind of medium-high heat, and it starts to cook, and it gets very, very crispy. And for some reason, you know, it cooks it much more evenly because you get a lot more contact. So that's what I did. Then after about 10, 12 minutes, take off the brick or the pan and you sort of peel, you know, lift up carefully and see if your skin's really crispy at that point. You're ready to flip. So you take out the pan. You carefully flip the chickens over. And then you don't put the brick back on because you don't want to mess up the skin. Then you just take the whole thing and throw it in a hot oven. So I had the oven at 400. You just take the whole pan, throw it in the oven. Cook it till it's done. It takes about another, this was a really big chicken, so another 20 minutes. Basically, you can cook it till the temperature in the thigh hits about 165. I never, ever go higher than that 165 max. That's it. Because anything higher than that, you're going to totally dry out the breast meat. I'm okay with the thighs being a little pink. Trust me, you'll live. Salmonella dies at like 137. You'll be fine. So anyway, I did that Friday night. It was delicious. We loved it. I had done it a few weeks ago, like I said. And it was really big chicken. So we still have leftovers from that one. There's two people. So that was Friday. Random. So then Saturday night, we get invited to go out to dinner with some friends of mine. And we go to this restaurant that only has three entree choices. You know, it's one of these places where they change the menu every day. Whatever's local, seasonal. You know, great. How I want to eat. What were the three entree choices? Hake, which is kind of fish. Risotto with braised short ribs in it. Or chicken under a brick. How weird. Huh. So I still had half of a brick chick in my fridge. I could have stayed home and eaten that and saved myself $60 on the meal. I didn't really want the risotto because I'm trying to lose a little weight. And a big pile of creamy risotto with braised short ribs was not really in the plan for me. So I had the hake. Now, I don't really love that whole family of fish. The whole, like, cod, hake, haddock, scrod clan. They're too lean, too white, too boring. It's very, like the chicken breast of fish, you know? They're kind of waspy, uptight. Blech. Too New England-y. Not my kind of fish, but it was my only choice. Now, normally, I would order two apps instead of an app and an entree. I like to order two apps. Often, what I do. But, you know, I sort of felt like there was group pressure, like I was out the group of people. Everybody was going to get an app and an entree. If it came time to splitting up the bill, it might get complicated. So I ordered an app and an entree. Then it turns out that three of the women in the group ordered one entree to share. Who does that? Three people sharing one entree. And what did they order? The chicken under a brick. I didn't even want an entree, and I wound up ordering one and an app. Anyway, so that was Saturday. So I didn't technically eat it that night, although that day I had eaten some as leftovers, as lunch. That was Saturday night. Then Sunday comes along, and we have to go to Long Island because we have to visit my brother-in-law because it's his birthday. So Adam gets on the phone, and he's like raving on the phone about this chicken that I made under a brick and how good it is, and we should do it. And so Noah says, oh, let's do it, not telling me this in advance. So off we went to Costco. We bought another chicken. We went out to Long Island. We did it again. Chicken under a brick for the third time. And Noah cooks a lot, and he's just put in this, you know, beautiful new kitchen. So I showed him how to do it. Took out the backbone, the whole thing. I showed him how to spatchcock and then how to cut it up and how to do it. So in the meantime, I'm out there, and his father, their father, is out there, who's like 83 or something. And he's a nice guy. He's a, you know, nice old man, still really sharp. He really likes to cook. He's really into food. But he is like inquisitive the way like a four-year-old is inquisitive. You know, if you're ever around a four-year-old, it's like, why? 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 Norman's like that. And he's sort of like a four-year-old, too, because he doesn't have all of his teeth. And he's very deaf, not like a four-year-old. Sometimes four-year-olds act intentionally deaf. He's really deaf. So he asks a lot of questions, but he can't really hear you when you answer. So here I am, like, trying to cook, trying to show Noah how to do this chicken. The exhaust fan is on because it makes a big mess. The pans are sizzling away. Their nine-month-old is, like, running like IndyCar laps around the kitchen island in her little scooter walker thing. And I'm screaming to be heard to answer Norman's questions that he's asking me over and over and over again, and that he's already asked me for all these years. There's no real kind of end to this story. I'm sure it's really fascinating to you, but it was this very odd confluence of events that led me to be cooking and eating this thing, you know, three nights in a row. And we still had it left over in the refrigerator, and we still have some left over. But what I wanted to kind of get to, you know, the point about this is that it's a really great way to cook this chicken. Like I said, it gives you all this great skin to surface contact, and it gets really juicy. And it's also much faster than roasting a whole bird. You can do the whole thing in about a half an hour, whereas roasting a whole bird's going to take you 50 minutes plus resting time. So it's a good technique. Oh my God, look at the time. We have to take a break. We'll be right back.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history. Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Why We Cook, the Chef Smarty Pants radio show. I'm Erica Wides, your host, Chef Smarty Pants. If you are a fan of this show and have not yet joined us on Facebook, I would love to have you fan the show. Become a fan of the show. You can find us on Facebook at Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Yeah, drop in, say hello. You can also always leave comments on the Heritage Radio Network homepage for each show. And you know, you can always podcast any of our shows on iTunes at any time, so you never have to miss a single episode of your favorite show. Anyway, so I was talking tonight about this technique that I used over the weekend for cooking chicken called pollo al mattone. It's chicken under a brick. And you don't need a brick. You can use a cast iron pan like I did. Now, on Sunday when we did this at Noah's house, we had an issue because he has one small cast iron pan, but it was way too small. But what he does have is a massive collection of All Clad and Le Creuset. He's got a little money and he has a lot of pans. So we did it in just regular stainless steel sauté pans, like All Clad pans. And it worked okay. It definitely did not work as well. Plus, he has an induction stove and I have a gas stove. So I'm not used to that. Induction, that's some crazy stuff, man. Those pans heat up fast and it's scary. It's like you're cooking, but it's invisible. I don't really like it. But it worked okay, but it definitely worked better for me with gas and cast iron. I'm kind of an old school purist that way. I like to see my flame, and I like the cast iron pans. But it came out okay at his house. And what I did actually at his house was I threw a big handful of peeled garlic cloves in the pan too with the chicken, so those roasted up in the oven. And then when the chickens were done, I took them out of the pan, and I had two pans going. So one pan, I smushed the garlic cloves up into the juices and added some white wine, and I turned that into a sauce, which was really good. I had also squeezed a lemon over the chickens when they went into the oven, so it was this really nice garlicky, lemony kind of sauce. In the other pan, he had a kind of slightly dried up loaf of bread, like a sort of a ciabatta, laying around. So I cubed that up, and I tossed it with the chicken fat that I had skimmed off the sauce and put those in the pan. And put them back in the oven. So we got like chicken fat soaked croutons. Yeah. Those were good. Those were seriously good. So that all kind of got scattered over the chicken when I served it. And I have to say it came out pretty good. But something about cast iron, you know, it gives a really intense crispness. But I think you can taste it too. I definitely think you can taste it. It's like in Chinese cooking when you use a very well-seasoned wok. They say that you get something called wok hei, which means the breath of the wok. You're basically, what you're tasting is the vaporized layers and layers and layers of fat that are burning off the surface of the wok. And I think you can taste the iron too. It just tastes better. But nonetheless, it came out okay. But so while I'm trying to cook, Norman, the father-in-law, is driving me bonkers while I'm trying to cook. He doesn't listen to the show, so it's okay. He'll never hear this. So every single time, I've known this guy for 10 years now. Every single time I've ever seen him, he asks me the same question. The question always is, how do you cook a chicken breast and not have it turn out dry? That sounded a little bit like Gilbert Gottfried, but picture Gilbert Gottfried at like 85 with really bad dentures and two hearing aids. That's Norman. So every time I see him, that's the question. Once in a while, he varies it to pork chop from chicken breast. It's like become a family joke. Like, we know he's going to ask me that. And every single time I go through the whole process and I explain what you have to do. And also explain to him that if you're going to buy like really cheap supermarket meat, especially the pork chops, they're going to come out dry no matter what you do. No matter what you do. You could eat them raw. They're still going to be dry. I try to explain that to him, but he's all about, you know, buying the cheap. So I'm trying to explain to him it's about the quality of the animals and what they're fed and how they're raised and whether they come from a farm or factory. And he's very well read and he knows all of this. He's like, I know all about that stuff. But he still insists on buying cheap. He won't. This is a guy who's been wearing the same members only jacket since like 1983. And I don't think he's ever cleaned it since then either. So he's not about to drop $40 on, you know, Heritage pork chops. So I think I'm going to get some next time we see him and cook them with him so he can really see the difference. Because, you know, I may buy my organic chickens at Costco, but he's buying, you know, the like super factory farmed crap pork chops at Walbaum's. And that's bad news. So I'm always explaining to him how it's done and, you know, it's about temperature and time. And so we go through this whole thing and he asks me a bazillion questions. We sit down to eat. Everybody loves it. Da, da, da. Throughout dinner, he's still asking me the same questions. We get back in the car to drive him back to Queens, and he's up in the front seat, so he can't hear a word I'm saying anyway, and he's still asking me the same questions, and I'm screaming the answers from the back seat. It's about temperature and time, like over and over and over again. It was like, I felt like it was Groundhog Day, the movie, about chicken. That's what it felt like. Anyway, so three nights of pollo al mattone, but came out pretty good. I'm a little tired of it. I have to say, like, I'm a little bit sick of it. I'm done. I woke up this morning like, I don't really want to eat any more chicken for a couple weeks, at least. I think I'm done. Anyway, you know, the thing, though, also is when you cook a whole bird, any kind of whole bird, is that you have to be in a group where people are willing to eat white and dark meat. Which is fine. Like, all I want is dark. I mean, I would like to breed a chicken that's just made of thighs. Like, just two little fat thighs walking around. I don't see the point in chicken breasts. Legs are okay. They're a little sinewy and stuff. But, you know, the thighs are like the perfect part of the chicken. But, you know, then there's always the people who only eat the breast. They're so delicate. So when you cook it like this, at least the breast meat stays pretty moist. It doesn't get dried out. Like when you roast it whole. I can't stand dry chicken breast. I'll eat it if it's juicy, if I do it and it comes out fine. But if it's like stringy and dry, bleh, yuck. So I would always choose a thigh over breast. You know, and also the thigh meat and the leg meat tastes so much better. It's much richer. It has much more flavor. And people always go, oh my God, you shouldn't eat it. It has all that fat. You know what? It's like minutely higher in fat, but exponentially higher in minerals and nutrition. The dark meat on chickens is full of zinc. Zinc is what keeps you from getting sick. That's what you take when you feel like you're getting cold, and many other minerals. And it's higher in protein, fractionally higher in fat. And anyway, if you're buying meat, you know, from animals that have been raised in the right way and fed the right thing, that fat's going to be good for you anyway. So, you know, it works out for everybody. But I think that people tend to associate dark meat with poverty. A friend of mine who grew up in the South said they always just ate white meat because dark meat was considered, you know, what poor people ate. That wasn't exactly the words he used. He is from the South. But to paraphrase it in a nice liberal northern way, that's why they only ate the white meat. I think, you know, in the old days when people raised their own chickens, the legs and the thighs, of course, were going to be much tougher because those chickens spent a lot of time running around the yard and flapping and flying Of course, they were going to be tough, but that also meant that their meat was going to develop a lot more flavor and a lot more complexity. But nonetheless, people associated white meat with the higher quality and dark meat with, you know, cheaper, poorer quality. It's like the expression eating high on the hog. You know, in the old days, I think it really comes from slave days where, you know, you were the wealthy farmer, landowner, landlord, and your serfs or your slaves or your peasants, you know, after you harvested the hog, they would eat low on the hog. So they would eat things like, you know, feet and tails and trotters. And you would eat high on the hog. You would eat the loin and the ham and the chops, which were high up on the animal. It's sort of the same idea. You know, the dark meat on a chicken is closest to its ass, closest to its butt. So I think sometimes people associate darker poultry with poop because it's closer to the chicken's butt. But I don't think that really has anything to do with it. And I was looking up some stats on this just to see, you know, what it was about. And Americans actually eat 10 times as much white meat as they do dark meat in poultry. 10 times as much. Think about all those poor chickens. 10 times as much dark meat. So what do we do with all that dark meat? Well, some of it gets turned into pet food. But a lot of it goes to Russia and to Asia because they wisely like the better meat. They think we're crazy for rejecting the richer, darker meat. And I think we're crazy too because I think it's better. But lately, apparently, the Russian government has been stopping the importing of American chickens into their market because those chickens get washed with chlorine. Now, washing them down with chlorine, I don't know, you know, I'm sure that's terrible. Chlorine is a carcinogen and we shouldn't be doing it. But that's pretty funny coming from a country that hid a massive nuclear accident from their people for years. Didn't actually tell them about it, but they're a little, you know, freaked out about a little chlorine in our chicken thighs. I'm sure it's all political. So the U.S. meat industry had to figure out a way to use up all this surplus dark meat because the foreign markets were collapsing for it. And so in the wacky world of food technology and meat science, you know, you can major in meat science. What's your master's in? Meat science. I majored in meat science with a minor in, I don't know what, food technology. So in the world of food technology, they have invented this method for processing dark meat to turn it into white meat. Of course, this exists now. Somebody figured it out. So they take the dark meat and they grind it up and they mix it with water and they centrifuge it at a really, really high speed. And they basically spin out the fat and the myoglobin. Myoglobin is what makes dark meat dark. And it's good for you. Myoglobin is, you know, full of protein, but it's what makes dark meat dark. So they centrifuge it out and the myoglobin and the fat separate out. And what's left is this, like, colorless paste of protein that now doesn't have the fat or the darkness, but it's still technically dark meat. And then they form that into a, like, a slurry, like an ooze, that can be formed into nuggets or other fun shapes. And it's a way of using up the massive amounts of tasty dark meat that we turn up our collective nose at. So, pretty smart. Right? So that will be hitting the market soon. Apparently that's going into production shortly so that they can use it up. It's sort of like how there's now whole grain Captain Crunch. Right? That's from an albino strain of wheat, by the way. That's how they do that. But anyway, that's Better Living Through Technology for the week. That's what your food industry is bringing to you. So go home, get yourself a chicken, cut it in half, take out the backbone, find yourself a brick, or steal a cobblestone from the street. Throw it in a pan, flatten it out. Let me know how it goes. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.